From the studios of NPR West, it's Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Alex Cohen. He writes poetry, studies psychiatry, and is considered the architect of ethnic cleansing in Bosnia. Radovan Karadzic was arrested yesterday after years on the run. A closer look at the man just ahead.
First, presidential politics. After 3 days in Iraq and Afghanistan, Senator Barack Obama is in Jordan and on his way to Israel. In Amman, he spoke with reporters for his first extended remarks since the Iraqi government essentially embraced his call for a pullout of U.S. troops in the next 2 years. Here he is recounting his conversation yesterday with American General David Petraeus, who disagrees with the senator about a timeline.
His concern has to do with wanting to retain as much flexibility as possible. And what I emphasized to him was, you know, if I were in his shoes, I'd probably feel the same way. But my job as a candidate for president and a potential commander-in-chief extends beyond Iraq. So that's something that I have to factor in. I have to factor in the perceptions of the Iraqi people and the statements by Prime Minister Maliki and his spokespeople in public that they are ready to see the Iraqi government take on more responsibility for security.
That's Senator Obama at a press conference in Jordan. He's also met with King Abdullah there and then on to Israel. We're joined by Karen Tumulty of Time magazine. Karen, I watched his press conference on TV. He seemed very cautious. He didn't make much of a point of coming right out and saying the government of Iraq has practically endorsed my plan for troop withdrawal.
That's right. He's caught some flack today from the Republicans for a statement that he and Senator Hagel and Senator Reid released last night, making reference to the fact that in their private conversations with Prime Minister Maliki, that he had, in fact, you know, endorsed a timetable, which, of course, is something he's done fairly publicly over the last few days as well. So I think they were trying to avoid the tradition in diplomacy where, you know, private conversations with world leaders are not talked about directly outside the room.
Karen, the press conference lasted about 45 minutes. A lot of it was on Iraq and Afghanistan. There were questions on Israel, too. Here's a part of what Senator Obama had to say about that.
I think it's unrealistic to expect that a U.S. president alone can suddenly snap his fingers and bring about peace in this region. What a U.S. president can do is apply sustained energy and focus on the issues of the Israelis and the Palestinians. And I do believe that an ultimate resolution is going to involve two states.
Karen Tumulty from Time magazine, what is Senator Obama going to be doing in Israel in the next 24 hours?
Well, you know, Alex, in some ways, this is politically the most treacherous part of his trip that is coming up here, because he has a ways to go with American Jewish voters, and had caused some anxiety 2 weeks ago with his comments to AIPAC about there needing to be a unified Jerusalem, which he then walked back a bit as well, and is now, of course, saying that is a subject for final status negotiations. He is being very, very careful with his language, but the one thing I think he can say safely and that he is going to be asked to commit himself to in his meetings with King Abdullah and with both Israeli and Palestinian leaders is a renewed and a consistent focus on the peace process.
Karen Tumulty of Time magazine with Senator Barack Obama on his tour now in the Middle East. Karen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Alex.
While Obama visits the Middle East, Senator John McCain is traveling through New England today. He's back in New Hampshire trying to rekindle the enthusiasm of the Republican primaries. NPR's Scott Horsley is there with the campaign in Rochester, New Hampshire. And Scott, what is John McCain doing there in New Hampshire today?
John McCain is holding a town hall meeting here on the New Hampshire seacoast, and that must feel pretty familiar to the Arizona senator. He held more than 100 town hall meetings here in New Hampshire during the primary. This was the state that rekindled his primary hopes, of course, about a year ago when his campaign was really in the dumpster. He famously said, "I'm going to go to New Hampshire. I'm going to invest all my time and efforts there." He won the New Hampshire primary. Of course, he won here 8 years ago as well. And so this is a state that has been good to John McCain. There is, however, a poll out today showing him in a dead heat with Barack Obama, which means that John McCain has lost some ground in the last couple of months. 2 months ago, he was leading Barack Obama by a narrow margin, and now they're in a statistical tie.
And that poll's in New Hampshire, Scott?
That's right. This is a poll by the University of New Hampshire, the Granite State poll.
So he's back there now, but is he even getting any attention with so much attention being paid to Senator Obama's trip to the Middle East?
This is a challenge for the McCain campaign. Barack Obama is on the front pages, and really what John McCain can hope for is to at least keep his campaign on the inside pages of the newspaper, or to get some paragraphs in the stories about Senator Obama's trip to the Middle East. And so the McCain campaign has been sort of kibitzing from the sidelines every day, criticizing Barack Obama for example, not supporting the troop surge a year ago, which is what John McCain argues has led to the success in Iraq and made it even possible to talk about a timetable for withdrawal. There's also been considerable argument about what constitutes an appropriate timetable for withdrawal, since John McCain's been hitting Barack Obama hard over his 16-month timetable, and now even the White House and the Iraqi government are talking about some sort of framework for a withdrawal. So they're playing that card, trying to sort of criticize the Obama trip from a distance. And also they know that foreign policy takes a backseat with many American voters to domestic policy, so they are talking about economics, and they've started running a new television ad this week about gasoline prices and highlighting John McCain's plan to promote offshore oil drilling.
Scott, it's summer there now, but in the winter, heating your home is a pretty big issue for people in that area. John McCain's been criticized for voting against financial assistance for people with heating oil. I'm sure that can't play very well in New England.
Well, that's right, Alex. I mean, across the country, people are concerned about gasoline that's costing more than $4 a gallon. But here in New England, people are very concerned about heating oil costs, which could be $5 a gallon this winter. And as you say, the Democratic Party has been faulting John McCain for voting on a number of occasions against support for the federal program that provides heating assistance to low-income families. Now, in fairness, John McCain represents a state where air conditioning costs in the summer are a bigger concern, but certainly no question that his offshore oil drilling plan is not going to provide the kind of short-term relief that New Englanders will be looking for with their heating bills this winter.
NPR's Scott Horsley is traveling with the John McCain campaign in New Hampshire. Thank you, Scott.
Great to be with you, Alex.
For analysis now, we're joined by John Dickerson. He's chief political correspondent for Slate.com. John, what does Senator McCain do to catch a break here?
Well, it's tricky for Senator McCain. In this election, we haven't really had a news cycle that's been longer than about 5 hours, maybe. And what Barack Obama has done with his world tour is basically block out a week where he's going to have control of the news cycle for an entire week long. What McCain's got to try and do is he's got two things. One, he wants to try and puncture some of Obama's rhetoric and these great pictures he's getting from overseas. But then also he's going to try and counter program. He's going to talk about the economy. He's got an ad out this week attacking Obama on the question of drilling offshore as a way to ameliorate these high gas prices. So he's got a two-track strategy here just to get himself a little bit of news.
You know, that's not a bad strategy because a lot of polls show that the economy remains a chief subject for voters. There's certainly a lot of economic news. We're going to be talking to a top economist from the Treasury Department in a few moments here. So this is what's on people's minds, but what's on the news is Senator Obama.
That's right. The economy is on people's minds. And the question for John McCain is he trails Barack Obama by more than 20 points on the question of the economy when you ask voters which of the two candidates do you trust to handle the issue of the economy. So McCain's going to try and inch up, maybe break down into maybe being behind by 15 points. Barack Obama is trying to do exactly the same thing on foreign policy. In polls, he trails John McCain by about 20 points or more. And he's trying to do the same. He'll never beat John McCain on the question of who would be a better commander-in-chief, or he probably won't beat him. But if he can shrink that margin to 5 or 6 points and have those independent voters think that they can be comfortable with Barack Obama as commander-in-chief, then he's gone a long way towards maybe wrapping up this election, because that seems to be the big question in voters' minds.
Here's Washington Post political writer Dan Balz this morning with a piece of political analysis. The events of the past few days have played unfailingly in the Democrats' favor. And he's writing about this near embrace or endorsement by the government of Iraq of Senator Obama's plan in 2 years, American troops should be out of Iraq.
There's been good news for Obama. Two good things. One, the pictures coming out of his trip to Afghanistan and Iraq make him look like a president. They have been perfect for Obama. And the second thing is that the Iraqi government appears to be all in favor of basically the Obama plan. But that's the good stuff. There are some problems for Obama here, and two of them are, one, the American generals have a very different view, and out in the middle of the country where people are going to vote in states that matter, they're going to care about what U.S. Military officials say, not what the Iraqi officials say. And the other problem is there are these little tendencies that Obama is brushing up against looking a little bit too much like a president, and he does have a problem with being a little too audacious, acting a little bit too much like he's already got the job, and that's something voters may very well not like.
Well, he did acknowledge that in his conversation yesterday with General Petraeus, he and General Petraeus clearly have a different view on this idea of whether there should be a timeline or not. It's plainly out there, and General Petraeus remains a very highly regarded figure.
This is the tough line that Obama has got to walk. On the one hand, he has to keep his pledge, which he reiterated on the eve of this trip, that he's going to have troops out in 16 months. That's the pledge he's made. He's sticking firmly to it. On the other hand, he doesn't want to look like he is completely oblivious to what the generals on the ground are saying. Those are two contradictory, tricky problems for him, because you can't say, I must get out on a timeline if all of your generals are saying, please don't do that. So when he comes back from this trip, he's going to have to somehow say that he listened to what he heard, he had an open mind, and on the other hand, he's got to stick to this firm timeline that he's been saying, you know, the Iraqis want it too. So we'll see how he can thread that needle.
And you referred to how Senator Obama looked, just the images of him coming out of this trip. In your column last week, you said he's got to avoid the Michael Dukakis helmet tank picture. He's got to not look foolish.
He succeeded. Basically, Obama looking very much like when the president goes over there. The president doesn't wear the flak jacket or the helmet, and yet we saw him with the general, and we also saw him with leaders in Afghanistan and in Iraq, looking again like a world leader.
John Dickerson, chief political correspondent for Slate.com. John, thank you.
Thanks, Alex.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Alex Cohen. Joyous celebrations and angry protests all night long following the news that Radovan Karadzic was arrested yesterday. He was one of the most wanted war criminals in the world. Karadzic had been indicted 13 years ago for his alleged role in the killing of nearly 8,000 Muslim men and boys. He also was the Bosnian Serb president for several years in the early 1990s. For more on the man who's been on the run for years, we're joined now by John Burns of the New York Times. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
If you could take us back to that time, what do you remember about the climate of fear that he created?
Well, it's an overworked phrase, perhaps because it is so apt, but Hannah Arendt's banality of evil applied in full measure to Radovan Karadzic. He was a delusional, strange, quirky man to deal with, who liked to sit up late into the night smoking cigars and drinking cognac and Slivovitz, and setting out this grand, mad scheme that he had to create a republic cleared of all but Serbs in Bosnia, and then link it to the greater Serbia of Slobodan Milosevic in Belgrade. And it was difficult to connect this man drinking his cognac, blowing clouds of smoke into the air, with the tragedy that was unfolding at his behest only a mile or two away from where he sat through these long evenings talking to people like me, artillery guns firing on the city of Sarajevo, reducing it to rubble, and murderous gangs of paramilitary thugs marauding across Bosnia, engaging in ethnic cleansing, and ultimately forcing about 2 million people to become refugees.
You mentioned the fact that you spoke with him personally. What do you remember most about talking to him face-to-face?
I tell you what comes to my mind first. I had been witnessing ethnic cleansing in the very early stages in eastern Bosnia, and I'd seen people being machine-gunned, men and boys, in village squares, and their families, mostly women and children, being driven out into long and miserable hikes across the mountains, fleeing these paramilitary killers. I'd written about this, I'd heard this strange phrase, which later on we all came to know so well, ethnic cleansing, and fell into a conversation with him only a matter of 48 hours or so after I had first witnessed this and described the miseries in the village square and described the people walking over the mountains, being, as I said to him, driven from their homes. He said, no, I got it completely wrong. I got it upside down. They weren't being driven from their homes. They were being liberated to go home. I said, what are you talking about? Yes, they're going home, he said. What we've done is made it possible for them to go home to their own people. This is something they should celebrate. At that point, I realized I was dealing with somebody who was quite preposterous, and indeed, I would say, delusional.
So it sounds like he had absolutely no sense of remorse whatsoever.
Absolutely none at all. Absolutely none at all. I saw him personally sitting at an artillery gun, 155-millimeter artillery gun. This is a battlefield weapon, firing shells into the heart of Sarajevo. These shells were hitting hospitals. They were hitting schools. They were hitting apartment buildings. It was the most astonishing thing to see, and he loved every minute of it.
How much time did you spend with him over the years, and when was the last time you saw him?
Well, I was in Bosnia in 1992 and 93, and I think I saw him just before I left at the end of 1993. And, of course, that was more than a year before the greatest atrocity of all, which was the Srebrenica massacre. But I can tell you that people like myself who were there and knew him well, we were absolutely astonished that the West, and I mean the United States and the United Kingdom principally, the United Nations, sent embassies, very distinguished people, to negotiate with Karadzic and General Mladic, his military partner in the ethnic cleansing, as if these were reasonable people that you could actually treat with. I thought that that was almost as big a delusion as the delusion which Karadzic and Mladic had fallen into. And looking back on it, you have to wonder what on earth was in the minds of the U.S. administration and the British government, the government of John Major, the administration of Bill Clinton at the time, that they would do that.
The irony, I think, of all of this is the fact that, meanwhile, he's got an extensive background in psychiatry, and when he was detained yesterday, he had been practicing for a while in an alternative medicine clinic.
I talked to him at great length about the practice of psychiatry. He spoke to me, I remember, one occasion in a long afternoon we spent at a cafe in Belgrade at the height of ethnic cleansing. I said to him, what exactly do you do in the practice of psychiatry? Well, he said, we have to deal with uprooting the delusional and returning people to normality. This is to deal with paranoiacs. I said to him that that's exactly the reverse, it seems to me, of what you're doing in politics, that you're planting the delusion, you're spreading the delusional. And he said, no, 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 I am firmly based in reality. Well, of course, he never was, and I doubt whether he was during the years when he was a ghost, when he was on the run. He's a very strange character altogether, one of the most memorable as well as detestable men that I have ever met.
Radovan Karadzic is also a published poet. What was his writing like?
Pretty bizarre. Some years before the shelling of Sarajevo, he had written a poem in which he prefigured that, and he described shells falling on a city, and you know, women and children and the carnage of the whole thing. But it was an astonishing thing that he, almost like Adolf Hitler with Mein Kampf, that he had actually sat down and written, even if it was a dream, as he told it in the poem, written or prefigured what he was actually going to do.
He's been on the run now for more than a decade. What are the charges that he currently faces, and what do you think is likely to happen to him next?
Well, he's facing the most serious crime charges of all, of course, principally genocide, war crimes. I think the indictment runs to 7 or 8 particulars. Basically, they have thrown the book at him. And, of course, one will have to hope that, and I think he will get, a fair trial at The Hague, and it'll be interesting to see what sort of a defense he puts up. I'm pretty sure he will not plead insanity. He will continue to defend his project, and he will defend it, actually, if I'm not mistaken, the man I knew would defend it as an act in service of humanity. So, you know, we're all going to be treated to some dizzying performances at The Hague, I would say, over the next 2 or 3 years.
John Burns of the New York Times speaking with us about the arrest yesterday of Radovan Karadzic. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
banking giant Wachovia posted a surprising first quarter loss, nearly $9 billion. That's a scary number indeed, but Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson says Americans should stay calm.
The American people have every reason to remain confident that the U.S. banking system is sound. The FDIC has made clear that of the nearly 8,500 insured banks and thrifts that comprise the U.S. banking system, 99% are well capitalized.
Paulson spoke earlier today in New York, where he also stressed the need for Congress to increase credit lines to the mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. We're joined now by Philip Swagel. He's the Assistant Secretary for Economic Policy with the U.S. Treasury Department. And if we could start off by talking about this plan to rescue Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, it could cost taxpayers as much as $25 billion. That's a lot of money. Why should the government step in to help them out?
What Secretary Paulson discussed this morning is that the plan is there to make sure that the financial markets have the confidence that the two mortgage giants, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, will have the ability to continue to securitize and buy mortgages. They're a very important source of finance to mortgage markets right now. Markets have had concerns. The plan is meant to be a backstop to them, to say that there's liquidity support and capital support so that they can continue to go on with their business. And importantly, if the plan succeeds, and so far it does seem to be providing stability to the market, there won't be any cost to the government.
And this would be just a temporary measure, correct?
It'd be for 18 months is what Secretary Paulson has asked for. In a sense, he said he doesn't want the next administration to come in and have a situation where the capability that he needed is expiring on them.
Before this plan actually goes into effect, one of the steps that would need to happen is that Treasury officials would look at the books of both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. They're doing that now. What exactly are they looking for, and when might that process be done?
The Fed and Treasury are going and looking at the books of the GSEs.
GSEs, these are government-sponsored enterprises. Is
exactly.
That correct?
Yes. Just because, of course, there's a disagreement, in a sense, between what the regulators see and what the market sees. The market obviously has concerns about the quality of the assets on the GSE books, and that's why we're taking a second look.
Secretary Paulson has said that this plan will bring stability to the markets. How much stability, and how soon might we see it?
Well, we've seen stability, in a sense, already, that the GSEs have been able to continue to raise capital from the markets. They've had bond sales that have gone relatively smoothly, and they're continuing to perform their mission of buying mortgages and securitizing mortgages. So in a sense, the announcement of the plan has helped stabilize markets, and we'd like to see the legislation passed by Congress to make sure that this stays in place and really gives markets the confidence that these entities are going to continue to do what they're doing.
We mentioned earlier the big losses posted today by Wachovia. There's been all sorts of signs that the economy is in bad shape. Today in his speech, Secretary Paulson referred several times to stresses and bumps.
Our markets won't make progress in a straight line, and we should expect additional bumps in the road. We have been experiencing more bumps recently.
Philip Swagel, is there any chance that these might be more than just bumps? What warning signals would you see out there that would trouble you?
Starting from the housing market, we've seen the stresses in financial markets go in other directions, to municipal securities and student loans. So, you know, who knows what's next? What's important is that we provide the market participants with the confidence that authorities are ready to provide support to make sure that the markets continue to function. One of the things that we learned from the Bear Stearns episode is that the markets are very interconnected, and that the failure of one institution can have systemic impacts. And so a lot of work has been done basically to say, where are the places where a failure of one institution can impact other market participants, and try to shore up those.
Of course, this isn't the first time that the U.S. has hit hard financial times. As you look back in history, is there anything that we can learn from past troubled economic times that we could use to apply for the current situation?
I would say the most important thing is that we do get through these, that financial disruptions do matter, and they matter for Americans. I mean, anyone who's looking for a mortgage, a home loan, you know, a student loan is affected by the disruption. So it does matter, but we do get through it, that the economy is resilient. And as growth rebounds from the slow growth we've had over the past 6 months, we should see that have an impact on the housing market and then also on financial markets.
Philip Swagel of the U.S. Treasury Department, thank you.
Thanks.
From NPR News, it's Day to Day. As Alex mentioned a moment ago, Wachovia, which is the nation's fourth largest bank, announced that it lost nearly $9 billion in the second quarter of this year. That's much worse than Wall Street had been expecting. Not a good sign for banking overall. Joining us is Marketplace's John Dimsdale. John, how in the heck can one bank lose $9 billion in 3 months?
Yeah, and in the same quarter last year, they made a profit of more than $2 billion. So it really shows what a swing it's gone through. Wachovia revealed that it has billions in bad loans on its books, either uncollectible or nearing default. And to try to stop all this red ink, the company is slashing its stock dividend by nearly 90%, and it's going to lay off more than 6,000 employees, or more than 5% of its workforce.
So, you know, at the same time, we have been seeing some better-than-expected performances by other banks in the same quarter. Wells Fargo and Citigroup, they didn't have a great quarter, but better than expected. So what happened with Wachovia?
Yeah, that's right. Well, the thing that hit Wachovia the hardest was its purchase a couple years ago of a California bank, Golden West Financial. And it seemed like a good idea at the time. It gave Wachovia, which had been a regional eastern bank, more of a national footprint. And Golden West specialized in very profitable adjustable rate mortgages. Remember, this was the peak of the housing boom. But now we know that Wachovia paid too much for Golden West, and Wachovia was stuck with billions in bad loans that Golden West made. And there's another reason for today's dreary earnings report. Last month, Wachovia replaced its CEO. They hired a former deputy treasury secretary, Robert Steele. And it's in Steele's interest to get all this bad news out on the table, to give him a clean slate to begin reviving the company from the bottom up. So some people say Wachovia is more aggressively taking charges and write-offs just to show that the bank's performance in the future will get better. And banking consultant Bert Ely says it will.
They're basically positioning themselves to ride through this storm. They're obviously not performing as well as Bank of America or BB&T, the other large North Carolina bank. But these results do not mean Wachovia is going to fall off the cliff.
So how does Wachovia propose to avoid the cliff?
Well, yesterday they announced that they're going to stop doing mortgage business with brokers. Brokers are these sort of freelance sellers of mortgages. And Wachovia will bring all that mortgage business back in-house so that they can keep a closer watch over who's getting those mortgages. Can they repay? Have we done the background checks necessary to know that we're making a loan to a reliable borrower who has the income or assets to cover their payments? So they want to try to avoid so many foreclosures in the future.
All right. Good. Thank you, John. John Dimsdale of Public Radio's daily business show, Marketplace. This is Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Alex Cohen. Here is a little quiz for you. What Olympic sport is the only one to feature both men and women playing against each other on the same court at the same time? Answer: badminton. It's considered by some to be the second most popular sport in the world. KQED's Rob Schmitz brings us this profile of two American Olympic badminton hopefuls.
If you're like most Americans, the only exposure you've had to this game has been something akin to a friendly rivalry at your neighbor's barbecue, a game you could play without spilling your beer. And you probably didn't sound like this. This is badminton, and according to ESPN, it really is the second most popular sport in the world. U.S. badminton Olympians Bob Mylotong and Howard Bach smash a birdie at each other so hard that you start to feel sorry for the small feathered object. The doubles team is in the middle of what's called a suicide drill, where one player feeds the other 100 birdies to different parts of the court. The drill helps them stay in the attacking position. The two say that's the key to beating the ultimate competition, China, who harbors the best teams in the world.
They tend to take over, and their attacking is very explosive. It was one of the best in the world, so we try to eliminate that.
They're going to want to control the net, so it's just who gets ahead of the game.
In badminton, the team that stays on the offensive usually prevails, and that's something these two are used to. They fought their whole lives to bring recognition to a sport that is largely ignored in this country. In fact, there's not even an Olympic training center. It was closed down after only one American qualified for the Sydney Games 8 years ago. Up to then, Bach and Myletong had spent most of their lives training there. They were left with nowhere to go. Myletong heard about a guy named Don Chu in Orange County, California, who had started his own badminton gym.
So I called Mr. Chu up, you know, wondering if he can let me train here and live here. And, man, he was great. You know, he allowed me to stay in the dorms here for free, everything, allowed me to work part-time here. I mean, he kind of saved my life there.
Since then, Olympic hopefuls have made the pilgrimage to this massive warehouse-style gym in an industrial section of Anaheim. Don Chu built the Orange County Badminton Club next door to his printing business in 1996. The badminton player from Thailand has become U.S. badminton's savior and godfather. His inspiration, he says, was the sad state of U.S. badminton skills he saw at international tournaments.
I feel like ashamed that every time I watch badminton, we got kicked in the butt so bad. So I said, oh my God, I can help the U.S. to, you know, come back and win the medal.
It won't be easy. The USOC has cut funding to the sport from $500,000 to $80,000 a year. Chu has stepped in with his own money. Just last year, he spent around $500,000 training Olympians. But it's still not enough. While Olympians in Asia make millions from sponsors and are celebrities in their home countries, the five members of the U.S. team, says Howard Bach, are strapped for cash. He works as a cashier at the Home Depot down the street in order to make ends meet.
You know, we try to do whatever we can, you know, stay with our parents or a coach part-time like Bob to try to pursue our Olympic dream.
The other hurdle for the U.S. team is the competition. Home team China has won 19 medals since badminton became an Olympic sport in 1992. The U.S., zero. But there is a gleam of hope. Howard Bach shocked the badminton world 3 years ago by becoming the first American to win the world doubles title.
Don't count us out because, you know, we've beaten top five players in the world. Hopefully we click at the right time.
We got harder, huh? Back and forth.
And if that happens and these two do get a medal, then maybe, just maybe, the sport of badminton will transcend its image in this country as merely a game you'd play at a backyard barbecue. For NPR News, I'm Rob Schmitz in Los Angeles.
After more than 60 years, some particular Holocaust survivors may be eligible for payments from the German government. These are people who worked in German-controlled ghettos during World War II as virtual slave labor. An estimated 20,000 of the survivors are still alive in this country. At a free clinic in Connecticut, lawyers help the survivors fill out applications for reparation payments. Diane Orson of member station WNPR visited the clinic to listen to stories.
Good morning, Mr. Davis.
Good morning.
80-year-old Albert Davis walks into a small room at the Jewish Family Services office in West Hartford. He's one of 22 Holocaust survivors who've come to apply for the German Ghetto Work Payment Program. The fund was established last September as a goodwill gesture to help aging survivors. Mr. Davis is a Burley Fellow, born Abraham Davidovitz of Siget, Romania, the son of a butcher. He was 13 years old when his family was sent to the Siget ghetto.
We dig ditches. They rounded us up. They took us out about 5-6 miles in order to dig ditches there. After a year and a half, they took us and they put us in a big synagogue before they sent us over to Auschwitz.
Where his family was killed. Albert Davis says in Auschwitz, Nazi officers ordered him to show his hands, which are big. He says those hands dug trenches in the camps, repaired machines, did plumbing, and saved his life. After the war, Mr. Davis made his way to Hartford, where he worked for 35 years as a meat cutter in the local Jewish deli.
They took all my youth, all my youth when I was young. They took it away from me. Some people have here, they're a, what do you call it, teenagers. I never had you, a teenager, and I never had an adult. I never grew up.
The new payment program is not for slave labor in concentration camps, but for work performed in the Jewish ghettos of Nazi-controlled Europe. There were hundreds of ghettos, many closed off by barbed wire fences and walls. Jews would sweep the streets, haul lumber, sew uniforms, in exchange for the bare necessities of clothing or food. Once Hitler's final solution began, the ghettos were destroyed and occupants deported to forced labor and extermination camps. It took many survivors years to talk about their experiences. And even now, filling out the reparation forms is difficult for 86-year-old Sonja Masna. She inspected German military uniforms in the Białystok ghetto in Poland.
They tried to black everything, to do the papers and things like that. Everything comes back to us. Very emotional.
Survivors must describe their persecution history and include specific places and dates. Attorney Eric Goldstein says they also have to verify that their ghetto work was voluntary.
That is a troublesome aspect to the application, but as long as the work wasn't done under an imminent threat of physical violence at the point of a gun or the tip of a bayonet, the German government will consider that to be quote-unquote voluntary.
Only living survivors may apply for the one-time 2,000 euro payment, about $3,000. Albert Davis says for him, the money means less than the fact that what happened to him is being recognized.
They can never make up for the things we lost. Never. All the money cannot help. I could be bitter about it, but I'm not. You see, like somebody says, could be half empty or half full.
Free legal clinics for the German Ghetto Work Payment Program are being held in cities across the country. For NPR News, I'm Diane Worsen in Hartford.
Back now with Day to Day. Despite the sagging economy, people are still spending plenty on their pets. Americans are expected to shell out $43 billion on their furry friends this year. Things like vet visits, puppy pills, and contraptions like Eddie's Wheels, two-wheeled carts for disabled animals. In addition to helping out dogs, Eddie's Wheels is creating manufacturing jobs in a part of Massachusetts where jobs are hard to find. Amy Mayer reports.
The metal factory behind me is one of the few left here. In the mid-20th century, big tap-and-die plants supplied tools for threading metal parts and employed thousands. By the 1970s, multinational corporations were buying up local manufacturers, laying off employees, and closing plants. Industrial jobs started going south and overseas. The Franklin County Community Development Corporation's John Waite says a skilled labor force and entrepreneurial spirit helped the region redefine itself.
People in the community said, we have to take control over our own economic destiny here, and they saw that small business was the way to go.
Though large manufacturers likely will remain a thing of the past, Waite says small businesses thrive here when they identify and serve a niche market. Eddie's Wheels is a prime example of that. Leslie and Eddie Grinnell founded their company after Eddie built a doggy cart for their blue Doberman, Buddha. The injured dog's vet could only offer a $5,000 surgery or euthanasia. Seeking an alternative, Eddie studied the canine skeleton.
And he went down in the basement and made her a set of wheels.
They got Buddha back on her feet. Soon, other dog owners were approaching them. When they outgrew the basement, they bought the abandoned sawmill across the street and rehabbed it into this factory. The carts are custom-built to help each disabled pet resume an active life. Internet access and nearby highways mean small companies like this one readily go global.
We're pretty well connected in Romania.
The carts also sell well in Japan, Australia, and across this country. Leslie Grinnell lifts the paralyzed back end of her dog, Sweet Pea, into a two-wheeled harness.
Close the yoke over her shoulders. Insert two pull pins to lock it on the yoke closed. Buckle the chest strap. And there you go.
Sweet Pea rushes down the ramp from the office to the backyard, pulling the cart with her strong front legs. Grinnell says dogs adapt quickly to using wheels.
When we put a dog in a cart, we're putting them back on all 4 feet in a normal posture. They're greeting the world as a dog again.
17 employees work in the factory, building carts that sell for $300 and up. The company doesn't expect to become the biggest employer around, but as long as people love their dogs, Eddie's Wheels will have a market for their product. For NPR News, I'm Amy Mayer.
Bear market, recession, inflation, these are money terms that still confuse a lot of us and remind others of the economic climate when Jimmy Carter was president. When my co-host Madeline Brand spoke earlier with Day to Day's personal finance contributor, Michelle Singletary, Michelle said that actually things are not as bad now as they were 30 years ago.
But it's still troublesome. What I want to tell people is that, you know, all year we've been focusing on a recession, and there are definitely things you should do in that case. But now you've got to worry about how to handle your money in an inflationary time.
So what is the best way to do that?
Well, you know.
I know what you're going to say.
You know what I'm going to say, and it's like I sound like a broken record, but people are not doing it. You know, one thing we can do is make sure your house is energy efficient. You've got to hoard as much money as possible to account for rising prices, which is what happens with inflation. So go through your house, turn down the air conditioner, turn off the lights. Listen, my kids were famous for leaving the lights on until I started charging them $1.
You charge your kids $1?
You better believe
every time they leave the light on.
Every single time they leave the light on, you owe me $1.
Well, that's one way to reduce your bill, I guess.
And you know they started to become very energy efficient when they started to owe mama some money.
I bet.
Shop smarter. Look for products that are going to save you money. And here's the other thing. Bend down when you go to the grocery store because the cheaper products are on the lower shelves.
What if you have a family that is doing all that and yet still is having trouble?
Then you need to look at how you're living your life. You may have to reduce yourself to one car. You may have to get a second job. Every single budget that I've looked at, the cell phone and utilities were just out of whack. I mean, people with $100 and $200 cell phone bills, who are you talking to? Get a prepaid phone. I mean, these are hard times, and the kind of luxuries that we have become used to that we think are necessities are not going to be necessities in an inflationary period.
Well, that you raise a good point, and that is that there are probably lots and lots of things that we take for granted now that really, when we look at it a second, third time, we could do with that. What are some other things besides the cell phones?
You know, you go to the standard cable, reduce to, and I'm not saying get rid of it completely, but go back to basic cable. You may have to go back to a one car and figure out how you can commute with your husband or, you know, combine trips and things like that using public transportation. I mean, whether we're in a recession or headed towards, you know, inflation, maybe not double digits, but certainly enough that it's going to cut people's budget, you've got to be drastic, and we've got to go back to some ways that were smarter in terms of how we used our money.
What are your feelings on going to regular supermarket stores versus going to some of these big warehouse clubs like Costco?
I think you have to be very careful about buying in bulk. In some instances, it absolutely saves you money by the unit price. But a lot of times people waste when they buy in bulk. Just dishwashing liquor, for example, you put that big bottles out there and people use it liberally. So what I did was I bought a little teeny bottle and then I would put liquid in there so that my kids and my husband would always think that we're about to run out. And it's the same thing with coupons. If you buy the store brand, you could still save money without using a coupon. Sit down, look at the coupons, look at what you're saving, and make sure that you are actually saving.
Michelle Singletary is Day to Day's personal finance contributor. She writes the Color of Money column for the Washington Post. Michelle, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Madeline Brand, thank you for that interview. Today's a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Alex Cohen.